Daquan Lamar Scott versus Commonwealth, Mr. Powers, Mr. Jones. Mr. Powers, how are you doing this morning?
Just fine, Your Honor. May it please the court, I am McMillan Powers, and I am here on behalf of Daquan Scott. This is on a single issue of whether or not the suppression of the single show-up identification of Mr. Scott by Stephen Carr and Jamie Carroll was in violation of the due process. And in order for that to occur, the law in Virginia is pretty clear on that, and I think both counsels have emphasized that. The defendant must show, first of all, that the show-up is unduly suggestive, and secondly, that it's not a reliable identification.
If that was the case, then what we have to look at is the other evidence to see whether that other evidence is sufficient, and forget about the unduly suggestive.
Right.
So that's really the focus.
The focus then becomes, if the court determines that, it appears to me that the Attorney General's office has pretty much conceded that it's too suggestive. So we will focus on whether or not it's reliable. Does that violate?
I don't know that I would characterize that as concession, but even assuming it was, concessions of law are not binding on us.
They're not. But if I can just speak very briefly to the idea of whether or not it's unduly suggestive, just clarify that.
By definition, are suggestive in the sense that you have one individual who's brought before the identifying witness to, unlike a photo spread or a traditional lineup where you have multiple individuals from which to choose. But it seems to me, if you look at the Aguilar, Spinelli, Wade, Gilbert, Wade, Stovall, Gilbert, Wade, Stovall line of cases, the Supreme Court of the United States specifically said that show-ups are permissible because if they're not, provided the officer doesn't, suggest that the individual is the individual they're looking for. Here the officer specifically said, if I'm reading the record, the light most favorable to the Commonwealth correctly, that that this is not necessarily the guy, or worse to that effect. But the point of the show up is to determine quickly whether or not the individual they've apprehended. I mean, one of the criteria for show up, as I understand it, is it has to take place relatively recent, relatively short time frame from the event. The officer can't suggest that this is the right individual and so forth. But the point is to let people go about their business and instead of arresting them, putting them in a more formal lineup or what a photo spread type of situation. So, I mean, show-ups can certainly be suggestive, but why is this one suggestive beyond just that it's a single individual and not multiple individuals? Well, which is not my first question.
It's suggestive for a couple of reasons. First and foremost, when the officers arrive and they take the two victims separately, different officers, they both say, "We think we have a suspect we would like for you to identify." That immediately plants the seed. Secondly, when they are shown my client, he is taken out of a police car and is standing between at least two officers in one instance, and there are four officers in the second instance. There's a spotlight on him, but he's extracted from the police car. His hands are behind him as though they were cuffed, although we don't have evidence that they were cuffed, but they're being held behind him. And in the second instance of the show-up, not only are there four officers, there is a canine officer with the dog there. Now, this just goes beyond being a show-up. It is clearly saying this is the perpetrator. He was already under arrest and detained.
The officers both testified that the two witnesses, Carr and Carroll, were unaware that they'd recovered the cell phones at the time of the show-up. And according to Carroll, at least, the officers, quote, "let me know if it wasn't him to not identify it was him." So it seems to me the officers are in compliance, or at least with respect to that show-up. With respect to Carroll, the officers did what they were supposed to do. So, and I don't know that, Judge Frank alluded to, we can certainly get beyond that and determine whether the in-court identification it survives that. But it strikes me that the at least the initial question of whether the show-up was suggestive unconstitutionally so is still an open question, at least to me.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I think it is not an open question any longer. when my client is extracted from the police cars, it occurs within 20 minutes, he's already under arrest. There's no reason why a photo lineup cannot be conducted at the police station. There's no reason why a real lineup cannot be conducted at a police station. There's no reason why they cannot bring the victims back the next morning, later that evening. There's nothing in the records to suggest that this man is a flight risk. He's already arrested. He's not going anywhere. He is the only suspect that they have in custody. And for them to take him out of the police car in the spotlight and have people identify him.
Exactly.
Exactly. But in this one, all these other factors come in, particularly the taking him right out of the police car and being surrounded by the officers. It's clear that they believe this is the perpetrator of the robbery. And for that reason, I believe it's unduly suggestive. I think it's constitutionally infirm.
Being just the unduly suggestive part, if in fact we're looking at the in-court identification, we'd be looking at bigger factors. How has the Collins satisfied all the bigger factors?
Well, the bigger factors are clearly laid out in the brief. And if you look there on page 20 in the brief, and also on page 21, I've gone through and stated how it is that the Biggers factors are not overcome here in this case.
Part of the talk about is the fact that he's got a mask on, you can't see them, but there are two cases at least that I'm aware of that indicate that in and of itself is not something.
A mask is not an end-all. Wearing a mask does not mean you cannot make the identification. Case law is clear on that. However, in this instance, what we have here is, for Carr's identification, he says that he observes the perpetrator for 10 seconds. He has other time frames in his testimony, but he says 10 seconds that he sees the face. That clearly is not the opportunity that the Biggers victim had during the rape. She's there confronted with this victim for an extended period of time, which is the same instance in Smith where you have the lady in the SUV, the prostitute, who is assaulted by these two men. She sees them for an extended period of time, and that's not a mask case. But in the Biggers, you have an extended period of time. There's a degree of attention. In this case, both of them testified that they were told to look to the ground or look down. They were not really focused on the perpetrator of the crime, in addition to the mask and all of that. The accuracy is a problem, and both of them testified that the assailant was about 6 feet and weighed anywhere from 130 to 160 pounds. The defendant, in fact, was 6'2" and weighed 230 to 240 pounds. And just to say, you know, the generic black male doesn't really, it's just not enough. There's no other real identifying mark substantiate the accuracy.
Let me recite some facts. You tell me whether you agree or disagree with them. Both Carr and Carroll had an extended period of time to review the defendant, which lasted between 5 and 10 minutes.
I disagree that is an accurate characterization of the record. The record does have that testimony in it. It also has the testimony where they walk their testimony back to 1 to 2 minutes, at least as to Carr. So if you want to say it's 10 minutes, that's fine, but the record also will substantiate a 1 minute period of time, but not a full observation of the defendant.
Right. And also, they testified they paid close attention to the defendant.
And they also testified we were instructed to look down, and that's what we did. So if paying close attention and looking down, at one point they say they looked down, they were in the car. Another time they were told to look at the ground, and I don't know how they got on outside the car.
And both of them could observe Scott's facial structure and features, although Carr waffled to some extent about that testimony.
Carl waffles significantly because he says the mask completely covered his face initially, and then he testifies it only partially covers his face.
They're threshold
questions that the trial judge has to get past, and that's the evil that we have here. When we have the
let me interrupt you because it seems to me you've got three hurdles to get over before you can be successful on appeal in this case. First of all, you have to show the show-up was
in front.
Bad, therefore taints the in-court identification. Secondly, as Judge Malvo mentioned, you have to establish that under the Vickers factors, the in-court identification cannot stand independently of the taint given by the show-up. And finally, that we haven't discussed it yet, the harmless error doctrine has to not apply. And here, explain why it wouldn't be harmless error if it seems to me if you take the identification completely out of the equation, you still got the fact that your client has both victim's cell phones in his pocket, a .22 caliber cartridge in his pocket that is the same caliber as the revolver found in the location of the robbery, and a backpack containing a black ski mask and two leather hooded jackets and a white tank top discovered in the area where Scott, your client, was first detained by Officer Moore. So why isn't taking all of that together render any error constitutionally harmless?
All right. I think that we get past harmless error this way. The jury comes back and asks the court, as they're deliberating, do we have to convict this man if he wasn't involved specifically in the robbery? The jury is having a difficulty coming to a guilty verdict to start with. If you take all the identification out, I have no confidence beyond a reasonable doubt that they would have convicted him of two robberies and the UFAs. I just don't believe, of the two robberies. I don't think that they would have done that. I don't believe they would have done that. This is the problem with harmless error always. This court respectfully defers to the fact finder when it comes up on most cases on appeal for sufficiency. We know that. That's the law in Virginia, always has been, always will be. However, when it comes to harmless error, this court does review the facts and makes a determination that the facts are sufficient beyond reasonable doubt. In this case, I don't think the court can do that because there's clearly a problem with the identification if you take the identification out and you look at the different factors that have to go.
Reasonable hypothesis of innocence that flows in the evidence by any identification, this would then become a circumstantial case.
It becomes a circumstantial case.
What would be the reasonable hypothesis of innocence that would flow from your client having the victim's cell phone in their pocket immediately after a robbery, along with the .22 cartridge that matches the caliber of the revolver used and found?
It was not used.
Clothing in the backpack and so forth. What reasonable explanation?
Okay, there's no evidence that ties that .22 caliber to the gun that was used in the robbery, but setting that aside, the reasonable hypothesis of innocence is my client's not very bright. These people come running. He says, here, I think the police, we're running, and we come here, and the perpetrator, who he somewhat knows, or one of the perpetrators that he somewhat knows, says, here, take this stuff, and he takes it and then gets caught. Now, is that a real good hypothesis of innocence? No, but it's a reasonable one that presented to the jury without identification might have landed him in an acquittal. And I want to reserve the last 2 minutes if I can.
All right.
Thank you.
Mr. Jones?
Good morning, and may it please the court. I am John Jones. I represent the Commonwealth, and we are asking the court to affirm Mr. Scott's convictions.
Let me ask you right out of the box. How will conceding that the show was constitutionally infirm?
It was not the Commonwealth's intent to concede that, Your Honor. It was just when I was briefing this, it seemed like the Biggers factors were a little bit clearer way to dispose of it. And as you mentioned, as Your Honor mentioned during previous argument here, there's a certain amount of undue suggestion that's inherent in any given show up. And you know, there was testimony about, well, did you follow all to the letter of the law, all the things that you were supposed to do? There was some indication that one of the officers had indicated at least that they had found a suspect, and there was an argument there. So the Biggers factors seemed to me at the time when I was briefing it to be the straight way to go.
Make sure you weren't conceding something.
Certainly not, Your Honor.
Yeah, I didn't see it in your brief, but I
want
to make sure.
Yes, Your Honor. And I just wanted to indicate point out at the outset here that there's an important difference between Carr and Carroll's identifications as they're presented to this court on appeal, and that's that Carr had an identification in court that was independent of the show-up. If you listen to the testimony at trial, Carroll consistently said, you know, she was asked, was this the man that you identified at the show-up? And she said yes. But Carr, on redirect, was asked, are you certain, and on page 293 of the appendix, the question was, are you certain that the person that you pointed out and identified to the members of the jury, that that is, in fact, the person that robbed you that night? Answer, yes. And so that, I think, puts this in a different posture. I think that that winds up rendering the suppression issue moot as to Carr's identification. I dropped a footnote about that, but since there are similar issues that, you know, if the court finds otherwise that are presented by the Biggers factors and the harmless error issue, I went ahead and did the full analysis for both Carr and Carroll. But I do think that Carr's is, you know, the suppression challenge to Carr's identification is moot, and the case law under that is Curtis, and then there's a pretty recent unpub from this court, Pennell, that I cited in that footnote in the brief.
Then on Carroll's testimony in court, since it doesn't seem that she does the same independent sort of...
Yes, Your Honor.
So what's your position on
that? I can't argue with respect to Carroll's identification that there was an in-court identification independent of the show-up. So that's where we go through all the Biggers factors and also the harmless error following up on that. So I guess the way that I'd put that is that the court indicated that there are three hurdles, and I think that's accurate with respect to Carroll's that Scott has to clear. But with Carr, I think there's a fourth hurdle that, you know, that may have been mooted by his independent in-court identification. And again, those are distinct elements. I think the court's already indicated that it's aware of that undue suggestiveness and very substantial risk of irreparable misidentification is the language the case law uses. They're distinct elements. So going down the Biggers factors, though, and again, the standard of review is important in this case because there is some equivocation. There are imperfect circumstances on several of these factors, but... to the extent that those all get resolved in favor of the Commonwealth whenever there's any ambiguity there, because we were the prevailing party below. So the opportunity to view, I'm not going to stand here and say that it was a great opportunity to view. He obviously had a mask. Both witnesses testified that the lighting wasn't great. But despite all that, they were able to identify distinctive facts about his appearance that they then testified about and gave to officers. You know, they recognized his eyes, his height, his skin color, his clothing, his build, and facial features, or facial structure came into it to some extent, more, I think, for Carroll than for Carr. But they were mentioned by both of them. And I cited a couple of cases that indicate that a mask does not prevent identification as a matter of law, and, you know, our courts have addressed that whenever there are other facts that a witness can point to supporting the identification, then, you know, that factor and indeed the entire identification can be admissible. So Hammer, Fan, and Ivy is an unpub from this court. Or the three cases on point that I cited in my brief for the court's convenience. The second biggest factor, the degree of attention, they both, and Your Honor, Judge Frank, I think you mentioned this during argument previously here, that they both testified that they paid close attention. So despite the fact that there was a gun in their face and despite the fact that they were commanded to look down, look away, they both testified that despite all that, they paid attention to, very close attention to the robber. And so to find that they didn't as a matter of law because there was a gun and because he commanded them to do otherwise would really flip the standard of review on its head, or maybe not as a matter of law, but to find otherwise would ignore the testimony of the witnesses on that point. On third, they gave both Carr and Carroll gave accurate descriptions of Scott, if perhaps a little bit imprecise. I think that the testimony was that their initial description to the officers was of his height, his weight, his skin color, the clothing that he was wearing. And I think that probably his location being near the CVS and his possession of their phones and gun could go into that, but I'm not sure if that goes into the description. But the other factors, they were accurate on. And one thing that I think is interesting about this is that Scott testified that the robber, as he knew, this hypothesis that there was some other person that he didn't know but that he knew had done the robbery and given him the phones, that he looked a lot like him, that he was about the same height, that he was a similar build but maybe a little stockier. And so for him to argue now on appeal that those descriptions were horribly inaccurate based on a couple of inches difference and perhaps a weight difference under a hoodie, I'm not sure that it bumps up against approbate reprobate, but it certainly undercuts the argument. And I think there's a possibility that that does offend approbate reprobate for him to say, yes, it was accurate, yes, I look very similar, and then now to say, no, we don't look anything alike. So on that third point, though, I think that pretty strongly weighs in favor of the reliability of the identifications. The fourth factor, the level of certainty displayed by both victims, was very high. There was no equivocation. There was no, well, I'm not really sure, and then coming around to it later. There was no indication that the police cajoled them or did anything out of the way to try to convince them that this was, that Scott was indeed the perpetrator. So from the very first, you know, they were very certain. I think that's very important here. That's one of the strongest factors that we have in favor of the reliability. And also the recency. This was within 20 minutes, I think the record establishes, or thereabout. And that's very strong. And one thing that I think is interesting is that Scott argues on brief that part of the problem with the identifications is that they occurred very soon after the crime occurred, and the only reason they identified Scott was because it was so soon after. But the case law gives a very different spin to recency. Recency is viewed as a good thing. The more recent, the better, because memories are fresh, and you know, it also, I think, goes to common sense that you remember something that happened 20 minutes ago a lot better than something that happened weeks, months, even hours ago. And so that, again, I think weighs very strongly in favor of the reliability. To the extent that there were imperfections or inconsistencies, that's typical grist for the jury mill, and it went to the weight, not the sufficiency. To require clinical accuracy in descriptions or optimal circumstances would be a categorical bar on a lot of identifications where the defendant moved fast or where the criminal moved fast, wore a mask, attacked in the dark. We can't have a categorical bar against people that got a pretty good look at this defendant to be able to identify them or not identify them as they're led to. But moving on to the harmless error issue, the standard on that is that it is beyond a reasonable doubt. It is a constitutional harmless error issue. But the Lilly factors that are listed in my standard review portion of my brief on this, the importance of the evidence within the grand scheme of the case, whether it's cumulative of other evidence, whether there was corroborating or conflicting evidence, and how strong the overall prosecution case was against the defendant, are all the factors that need to be...
Do you want to respond specifically to counsel's response to my question, which is his position, I'll try to do justice to it, but I understood his position to be essentially that without the identification, what you've got is the possession of the cell phones in the appellant's pocket, the cartridge that, while not identified with a specific gun, does match the caliber of the weapons used and found in the area. The backpack containing the clothing found in the area, and the flight, basically. His argument as well, taking all of that, it still supports the reasonable hypothesis because then it becomes a circumstantial case. It supports the reasonable hypothesis of supporting his client's assertion that he was handed this stuff in passing by somebody he knew casually, and when they ran, he decided to run. What's your response to all that?
I think that a reasonable fact finder would have rejected that hypothesis given the rest of the body of evidence without the identification. And I think, again, whether the challenge to cars identification is moot or not has some bearing on the harmless error analysis, because if Carr's identification was admissible in any event, then Carroll's identification was cumulative. And then you have that entire body of evidence that Your Honor mentioned. And I had a list here that he had the headlong flight. He was found a half mile from CVS within 5 minutes of the robbery. He had the phones. He had the bullet from the gun in his pocket. He was the gun was found in a place where the officer testified that the canine unit had briefly detained him over by the vacuum area at the Red Barn. And then, again, that was identified as the gun, not just a gun, but the gun from the robbery. Both witnesses identified that gun. They also identified the ski mask that was found in the backpack near where he was ultimately detained. His flight, again, and his own testimony, he admitted association with the robber, acceptance of the phones that he knew were that his possession of them was wrongful, and he even observed some conversation going on that turned out to be the robbery by his account. And he knew he looked a lot like the robber, and it would have been very improbable that the jury would have credited that testimony over the strong evidence against him. And they could have taken the aspects of the inculpatory aspects of his testimony, believe them, and then believe that he was lying about the rest to try to evade guilt. So yeah, I think the entire body of evidence viewed in its totality, even if you take both identifications or one identification out, still clears the harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, assuming that there was error there. And some language in Commonwealth versus White from the Supreme Court, that it's wholly implausible that any reasonable fact finder would have acquitted him on this record, even without the identifications. So, you know, it's my conclusion. I think that it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The jury question, the issue of the jury question that the prison counsel brought up, it seemed to get more P1, P2 liability. Like if he was the guy at the edge, like that was acting as a lookout or whatever, as an accomplice, if he was helping with the robbery more or less, would he still be liable for the robbery? And I don't think that the identifications get to that. I think if anything, the jury question indicated the jury may have been a little suspect about the strength of the identifications, which again goes to downplay their importance in the overall Commonwealth's case. So beyond that, if the panel doesn't have any other questions, I just rest on my brief and ask that the court affirm.
Thank you.
In regard to the independence of Carr's identification at trial, and counsel has cited that to the record. However, if you look at the record about 20 pages earlier on page 268, you will see that Carr is asked, how certain were you that night? And he says, I was pretty sure. And how certain are you now? Without a doubt. And that is the harm of the pretrial identification on a show-up. I'm pretty sure. I get to trial 6 months later without a doubt. And that's the problem. That's why it is harmless beyond reasonable doubt. We win that argument because now the testimony has gone, I'm seeing this man, yeah, I'm pretty sure that's the guy. We get to trial, we get to suppression hearing, and the testimony gets better and better and better, which is not atypical of the suppression of show-up identification, as Your Honors are probably very well aware, having tried these kind of cases. But that's the problem here, and that's why I believe this case should be sent back for retrial without the identification of Carr or Carroll. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll sit down and recounsel and take up orders.